Welcome to the Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March 9, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are brought to you by Kaplan Financial Education and by your state society of CPAs. This is Ed Zollars, and we're going to be talking this week about a few things that have gone on. We'll start with a discussion about an attempt of a taxpayer to get a late 475F election let through the system, and we'll tell about first why you'd want to make that election, and secondly, about how the taxpayer fared trying to get that. We'll look at an IRS ruling about whether limitations on deductions of losses from partnerships or other operations that are limited due to passive activity loss rules or limited due to lack of basis or lack of at risk. Do those which affect income taxes also affect self-employment taxes? We'll take a look at that side of the equation. And then finally, we're going to talk about the IRS granting relief this week from having to file some Form 3520s and 3520As for certain tax-favored foreign trusts. And so we'll talk about a little bit about that and how that works as we start talking about this week's activities. So let's move on first to our first issue for this week. And our first issue is looking at this question of getting late relief for the election under 475F. This is Private Letter Ruling 2020-09-013. This ruling came out on February the 27th of 2020. Now, what in the world is a 475F election? Well, the catch is this applies to dealers and traders in securities. And primarily, we're talking about it for most of us, it's going to be a trader's issue. Okay, a trader in security, let's remember the definition of what that is. Most people who buy securities are investors, right? Investors buy and hold for, you know, increase in value in the underlying securities. They are, you know, they tend to hold for some period of time. Traders, instead, are people, and generally we're talking about what would be more generally known to our population as day traders, are those who buy stock and may hold it for just a couple of minutes. They are trying to play on very, very, very short-term swings in the market. Now, some people are very good at that. Most people are really bad at it. So it's probably the way, tongue-in-cheek, to say how you get a small fortune is to start with a large fortune and become a day trader. Now, this can be a problem because that trading is still considered to be the sale of a capital asset. The stocks still become a capital asset for this purpose. So that means that if your client goes in and does really, really bad with day trading, they are probably going to have net losses from all this day trading activity from the trades they executed of far more than $3,000 in a year. We are talking about far, far more than $300,000 in a year. Like $600,000 or $1 million or whatever, because they've blown through this huge chunk of funds that they have, you know, whatever they made their money in, they just found a way to lose it. But the problem is, you got a $3,000 a year cap on deducting the loss. So that's a significant problem because now, well, that loss will carry forward, but until such time as we can actually use that loss in a future year, we're kind of stuck. So the question becomes, how do we, you know, is there a way around this? The answer is yes. You can make an election under 475F to use a mark-to-market method of accounting. If you make the mark-to-market election under 475F, a couple things happen. At the end of the year, whatever you hold at the end of the year, you know, when the year ends, you're deemed to have sold that, right, and repurchased it the first day of the next year. Now, what that does, that forces a capital gain. Now, some of you may have heard, you've had discussions about that theoretically in some tax proposals being made by some of the candidates. But, and there's lots of discuss, oh, that's horrible and that's awful. And we won't get into that whole discussion because in this case, it's really irrelevant. If you're a trader, generally, you don't want to be sitting in with the security overnight. You're playing minute by minute. Why would I want to hold something for hours until the next morning before I could do something? You're probably going to cash every day anyway. So the positions you would hold at the year end of the year will be nil, right? You're not going to gamble the whole weekend. You know, for instance, if you're a trader, you didn't have something there sitting there Friday unless you made a mistake that you didn't get out of, because you don't want to wait the whole weekend to find out what happens on Monday morning, right? You can't do anything during the weekend to fix the problem. So, yeah, you know, you're going to play it and you're going to be out and going to sit in cash over the weekend and come back and do your trading Monday morning. So it's not really a big loss. And the key issue is, though, once you make that choice, then your losses and income become ordinary. Now, the income being ordinary is probably not that big a deal. Why? It's still not self-employment income, because it's still a gain from sales securities, and that's excluded from self-employment income by 1401A as an exclusion, so don't worry about that. But number two, do we really care? It's taxed as ordinary income. The only reason we'd care is if we're sitting on a big long-term capital loss or something we'd created. So generally, the idea is we don't care about the income. We'll take the loss as ordinary. But the problem is this particular election date has to be made very, very early. If you want this election to apply, your taxpayer is a trader. If they want this election to apply for 2020, yes, I did say 2020, they have to make that election by April the 15th if they're an individual. And if they were a pass-through entity, they'd be making the election basically by next Monday, on March 15th, or March 16th in this case. You have to make it by the unextended due date of the return for the year before the year you want the election to apply, unless, in fact, you just didn't file a return for that prior year. You know, for why it weren't required to file a return, I should say didn't, but weren't required. If you're going to go on extension, you have to send in the election with your extension. Why is it so early? Because they don't want people playing this game of waiting till you're in and saying, oh, turns out I did lose a lot of money. I want to treat this as ordinary, not capital. There are huge backward-looking advantages if you could wait till the end of the year. So that's why they require you to make this choice early in the year before you know for sure how the year is going to work out. The fact pattern in this case, private letter ruling request to get late election relief under Regulation 3.01-9100-3. As long as an election is an election date that was set by the IRS, so it's a regulatory election, it's an election where Congress didn't give us the day to make the election by, but rather left it to the IRS. If that's true, the IRS has the right under Regulation 301-900-3 to grant relief. So this date is actually set by the IRS we actually got the date set in Revenue Ruling 99-17. That gave us the date to make the election. So the IRS clearly has the authority to waive the date. In this case, we have a taxpayer. He was a trader, and he lost a bunch of money, right? He had some that was in a partnership, and then he went out on his own, and various reasons, by the end of the year, he had lost a bunch of money. Now, he made his election with the return, and actually the election is a two-parter. You make the election, but then you have to change your accounting method because you're not using mark-to-market usually. So you change your accounting method and you do that. The change of accounting method is automatic and it's made at the end of the year, right, on the 3115. But the election goes earlier. Well, apparently he didn't understand that. He went ahead and filed. Well, at least he claims he didn't understand it. Now, here comes our issue. He wants the IRS to say, I understand it, but now, I need to, you know, would you please let me make this election late? I'm sorry, I just didn't know that, you know, that's how this worked. Well, under Regulation 9100-3A, two things have to be established by a taxpayer to be able to get late election relief in any late election, not just this one. They have to show they acted reasonably and in good faith, and they have to show that the granting of relief does not prejudice the interests of the government. Now, I've always thought that second one was interesting because the theory was you probably wouldn't be asking for relief unless the election was going to essentially lower your tax. So that's not really means that it's going to lower the tax. It's a little more subtle than that, not that broad. But the problem is this particular election over the years, it's been very clear the service is very rarely. I can only recall one case of a private letter ruling I read a number of years ago where the IRS allowed this to happen. And that was because, if I remember my history right on it, there was a technical termination of a partnership. The prior partnership had been made the election. They didn't realize the new one had to remake the election. And there the IRS decided, yeah, okay, that makes sense. We understand. We understand the issue. We don't have a problem. But in this case, they're saying there's an issue. And one of the key tests they have is normally the reg tells us that a taxpayer is not acted reasonably in good faith if facts have changed since the due date of the election that now make the election advantageous to the taxpayer. And that's your deadly part about this one. From April 15th until the end of the year, this taxpayer did not incur capital gains that would have offset his capital loss beginning of the year. Now, he might have gone ahead and not worried about this election if he had the gains. He might have preferred to treat them as capital, you know, to let him go ahead through the capital routine instead of being ordinary losses, right? You know, we could have seen there are various ways where it might have been better. So essentially, we're saying, you know, he didn't do that. They're saying, so first thing is, you didn't meet that criteria, right? You have the advantage of hindsight now. You know, and the key issue is, it's not hindsight in the sense of things that you didn't know on the date of the due date of the election. Being able to get a late election is a huge advantage for you over the people that filed the election timely. So because of that, we think that you didn't act reasonably. But more importantly, would it prejudice the interests of the government? Well, the IRS has, under the regulation 301-900-3C2II, it also says that if an election requires an adjustment under 41A, or would require an adjustment under 41A, if the taxpayer changed the method of accounting for which relief is requested in a taxable year, subsequent to the taxable year in which the election should have been made, there's a problem there, right? You have to make that election, 3115. Now, the taxpayer said because he'd gotten rid of everything by the end of the year that really there was a zero 41A election. So they're saying that that rule didn't apply. The interests of the government were not being prejudiced. The problem, the IRS said, was it says if an adjustment is necessary does not necessarily mean a zero 41A adjustment is still an adjustment. 41A adjustment is required whenever you make this change. The fact it happens to come out to zero doesn't change the fact there's still an adjustment. So even though the adjustment has no effect, it still counts. So the IRS said, you are not going to be granted relief because this both failed in terms of you acting reasonably and in good faith, and it failed in terms of prejudicing the interests of the government. And for that reason, we are disallowing your late election request. Sorry, guy, you can't be a traitor for the year in question. Hopefully he made an election protectively with the next return if he continued doing this. Probably ran out of money, so maybe he's not going to be able to continue doing it. But if he continued doing it, hopefully he fixed it the next year because he was too late. Key takeaway, if you have a client who is a traitor, remember this is a super early election. You are almost certainly not going to get relief if you make the election late. You want to make triple sure that you get the election done in time if you talk with a trader client. If a client indicates they are going into trading, make sure that they understand the need to make this election and they understand the need to do it in a timely fashion and they understand that this can't be put off until after the due date of April 15th. That also raises a problem that if you take on a new client and it turns out they're a trader, having put them on extension, that's a danger for them. And that also causes problems because we all know we're going to get phone calls in the next couple of weeks, like around April the 10th, of somebody, oh, I'm sorry, my CPA, I just discovered my CPA died in October. It's like, really, just now? That means that you weren't even checking to see who's going to do the return this year. And I need somebody to do my return. Can you handle it? And you'll say, well, bring it in and we'll put you on extension. This opens up a potential exposure for the firm, you know, in an area like this. If you were to discover that this guy was a traitor and, well, you had the material in time to know they should have made the election. Yeah, that's As I said, be careful with this one. Just kind of watch it. It's an issue. Next up is the Chief Counsel Advice 2020-09-024. This one was also issued on February the 27th of 2020. And this one takes a look at an interesting question. You have a partnership, or it doesn't have to be a partnership, could be a partnership or S-Corp, could even be a sole proprietorship if it's at-risk issues or 469 issues. But let's say a partnership. Let's make it easy. So I got a partnership. It's carrying on a trade or business. I am not a limited partner, so it's generating a loss, right? But I can't claim that loss because I've run out of basis. Now, I'm in the business. I'm working in the business. I don't even have to be working. Theoretically, 469 can still work with me, but we get into all these neat questions about self-employment income. But let's just take the fact that that's self-employment income generally. So I have a $50,000 loss from the partnership this year, and my line shows a negative $50,000 self-employment income. I don't have any basis, so I can't claim a $50,000 loss. Can I still reduce my self-employment income for my sole proprietorship by that $50,000 loss on the K-1, even though I can't take the loss for regular income tax purposes? Now, this question is not as weird as it might seem initially, because as you've probably been aware, most of you should be, if you have an operating loss and you carry that loss into the following year, even though it came from an item that generates self-employment income, that NOL doesn't reduce your self-employment income the following year, right? There are different rules for regular tax and self-employment tax and how we do it. They can be different from time to time, so you have to be careful with it. So the question became here, even though I might be barred by at-risk rules or I might be barred by passive activity rules, can I still offset that $50,000 against my other self-employment income? The IRS notes in a footnote, actually, to this ruling that some taxpayers have tried to argue that Revenue Ruling 56375 allows the reduction. And they claim it because that particular ruling, which looks at really taxpayers who are, you know, we look at guaranteed payments and losses from a partnership, and can you net the two for SE? And that ruling says you can. Well, some taxpayers said, well, that never actually mentioned having any basis in the interest when he did the offset. So they're saying because of that, hey, basis and other limitation rules don't limit it. Well, the IRS in the footnote says, look, that ruling simply is silent on the issue. And they say, in fact, the way we read it, it implies you could take the loss for regular tax purposes. So that revenue ruling does not itself justify claiming that there's no limits. The IRS said, rather, if you look at the actual details for each one of the three tests and what they eventually rule on here, it's kind of weird because the actual ruling talks about, you know, 469, or it actually talks about 454 at risk, or it talks about 704D basis. But then they also put passive activity in the actual text of the rule of the advice. So we're going to cover all three. The IRS says first, if you look at the regulations for passive activity losses that are held back, you'll note that an example very explicitly discusses about a partnership loss that came out limited in this case by 469. You know, we didn't materially participate. That caused the loss to be limited. And the example specifically says at the end, and they added emphasis to this in the IRS document, the IRS advice, the memorandum, they said, look, this particular thing, it still does not reduce it because it's blocked. You can't do it. The IRS will keep coming back the fact that 1402A keeps referring to losses allowed for subtype chapter A. They're saying, look, it's not allowed. They also said, look, section 704, when we talk about a partnership, and we're talking about a partnership and what's SE income, the 1402 regulations specifically reference that a partner's share of that income is based on what's allocated to the partner and what's allowed on the partner's return, and they specifically reference what comes through to you under 704. Basis is controlled by section 704D. Thus, the IRS says, look, basis is a limiting factor, and if you cannot claim the loss due to basis, you cannot claim the loss in offsetting self-employment tax. They come to a similar situation here for 465. I said 45 and 65 for at-risk. They're saying, look, that only allows deductions. It affects deductions that are allowed for subtitle A. Subtitle A deduction has to be allowed for 1402 to get the loss. So if your loss is barred by at-risk, basis, or passive activity, that disallowed loss is also going to disallow the related self-employment loss. You can't use those losses against self-employment income. Now, as always, please remember we are talking about a chief counsel advice here. Obviously, you got a different idea. You want to challenge in court, go for it. But do realize that at a very minimum, why I think it's important to look at these is it does tell you the national office in D.C. has a memo on point. And doesn't mean you can't disagree with them. They sometimes put out memos that are just flat out wrong. But it does mean your client should understand that if there's not an obvious error in the memo, that it certainly is a much higher risk to take a position against this than it is not to, because, you know, if the IRS, you know, if you're examined and the agent uncovers this from national office, agent's not going against national office. Appellate conferee's probably not going against national office, right? Counsel's office, they're going to say, yeah, go to court. We can analyze this. Go to court. You know, we're going to win. So it is an issue on a risk standpoint you should be aware of. Finally, the IRS issued Revenue Procedure 2020-17. That one was issued on March 2nd. And what this ruling does is provide us with some relief from having to file forms 3520 and 3520A in some cases. This is reporting required by IRC Section 6048. Under 6048, if you're a U.S. person, you have to file an annual report, generally on one of those two forms. If there is a transfer of money or property to a foreign trust, if you have ownership of a foreign trust, or if you have distributions from a foreign trust. The information goes on the 3520, annual return to report transaction with foreign trust and receipt of certain foreign gifts, or it goes on 3520A, and I should say and/or, annual information return of foreign trust with U.S. owner under Section 6048B. Under Section 6077 of the Code, there are some rather nasty and very significant penalties for any taxpayer that fails to file that form. So, essentially, you need to file it. Now, the IRS decided that we added a number of years ago, may I remember, under 6038D, some requirements for taxpayers to report additional information, right, on their 1040 about certain specified foreign assets. As well, we also already have the rules requiring FBAR reporting of certain foreign accounts. The IRS said, based on that, they're going to define certain tax-favored foreign trusts, you know, that are essentially maintained under the law of the foreign country, that are given tax advantage by that country, where the IRS says, we don't really need this 3520 filing as well. Now, remember, this does not exempt you from FBAR reporting. It doesn't exempt you from the reporting to go on the tax return, right? The one that goes with the 1040. Those things are still going to be required. So be aware of that stuff. But it does allow you, which is, and I should say, that's Form A-938, Statement of Specified Foreign Financial Assets. That's on the 1040. But they are going to eliminate the problem for certain foreign assets. If you own, and the key issue here, the IRS had previously given relief to certain Canadian retirement programs, and they mentioned that here. And that particular relief was a number of years ago granted for those programs that eventually got fully granted this relief here. We're now going to expand that a bit. So if you have to be an individual, a U.S. citizen or resident, who basically had, you know, who has been compliant with the law generally, right, otherwise complies with the law, and you have either a tax-favored foreign retirement trust or you have a tax-favored foreign non-retirement savings trust. If you have either one of those, then there will no longer be a 3520 or a 3520A filing for those categories. Now, what are those categories? Well, a tax-favored foreign retirement trust, right, is created, organized, or otherwise established under the law of foreign jurisdiction as a trust, plan, fund, scheme, or other arrangement to operate exclusively or almost exclusively, to provide for, to earn income from provision of pension or retirement benefits and ancillary and incidental benefits that meets the definitions that the IRS provides, and it generally has to be exempt from income tax under that entity's law. There has to be annual information reporting is provided to the relevant tax authorities in that jurisdiction. Only contributions with respect to income earned from the performance of services are permitted to go into the trust, and contributions to the trust are limited by a percentage of earned income of the participant and are subject to an annual limit of $50,000 or less to the trust, or subject to a lifetime limit of $1 million or less to the trust, right? And we do it using foreign exchange rates. They bring that up. Withdrawals, distributions, or payments are conditioned on certain requirements, right? And if it's employer main trust, it must be non-discriminatory, right? Actually provides significant benefits for a majority of the employees, and the provider of the trust to eligible employees are non-discriminatory. If it meets all those requirements, that's the retirement trust that skips. The non-retirement trust is a similar type structure, right? To provide for earned income for the provision of medical, disability, or educational benefits, and meets a similar set of requirements, being exempt from income tax. Again, have annual reporting. Contributions must be limited to $10,000 or less annually, or $200,000 or less on a lifetime basis. And withdrawals from the must be conditioned upon having the medical, disability, or education benefits, or have to be penalties to the withdrawals and all those sorts of issues. If you meet those requirements, again, you're exempt. Now remember, there are detailed requirements listed here for each type. Make sure you check under Section 5 of this rule procedure that the trust your client has meets all of these requirements. That will very possibly require you, if you don't have the expertise, to have somebody with expertise in taxation for the foreign for the foreign country give you a ruling that these requirements have been met. You know, it meets all these required conditions for filing and that this type of program works. My guess is eventually Treasury may give us some guidance on specific countries and programs that are covered by this. So keep your eyes open. But it does mean, yeah, we won't need the 3520. We won't need the 3520A filings for those particular trusts. So that's good news, because those are sorts of things that in many cases like these trusts, arguably nobody was getting away with anything. By not filing those, the penalties looked horrid, and it was a mess to go ahead and have to file them and tell clients, well, you haven't been filing this, and actually there's this huge penalty for not filing, and yeah, we probably can get out of the penalty for reasonable cause, but we can't say for sure, because you never can say for sure the IRS is going to view something as reasonable cause, or if you go to court, the court will agree. So this is a lot nicer issue to solve the problem going forward. Again, we solved it for the Canadian accounts a number of years ago. We're now going to solve it for these accounts in terms of the reporting issues there. But do remember, it does not change FBAR, right? Has no impact on FBAR reporting, nor does it have any impact on the 8938 reporting for these accounts. So don't think that you can ignore these accounts entirely. They're still required under those two reporting structures. And if you fail those, seems to indicate that you may very well still have this problem now with not filing 3520. So you have to make sure you stay compliant on the other issues. Okay. Well, hey, hopefully you guys are going to have a good filing week here. It is that week, the first extensions. Please remember the extended due date, because March 15th falls on a Sunday. We're going to be doing the 16th. Monday the 16th is our due date for our S corporations and partnership calendar years for both. Please remember, right, that thing comes up. Remember, for partnerships, it's probably not a bad idea to put a partnership on extension that cannot opt out of the comprehensive partnership audit regime or the, you know, BBA regime, whichever term you tend to use for that new system. Remember, because at least apparently we could file a superseding return all the way through September 15th as long as we get that extension. So that's kind of important to be able to do that. So you want to go ahead and get that filed. We'll take a look at some of our other, you know, remember that going on. So those documents go in place. We then will start heading toward our regular due date, right? April 15th, the really fun date coming up in a month. So I'm sure you're all getting inundated with client information. The partnership K-1s are beginning to come out fast and furious from the publicly traded partnerships. I'm finding that out. I got some clients that have a number of them, and we get notices every day they're being issued. So all that fun's starting. So yeah, the good fun time of the year is here. Please remember, we're going to be doing CPE for 2020 coming up soon. So you want to take a look at your state society, see what they're offering you. Again, we offer it this year from a number of our participating societies. We offer it both as live in the room, and we offer it as broadcast. Again, so that's still the broadcast versions. You're going to still get the live, right? Remember, I kind of talked about live rebroadcast, and then there's just, you know, flat out self-study. Well, we do have a lot of live that are broadcast at the same time. I do that in Arizona. I've done it in other states. I do it normally in Idaho. We do the other option. We do the other option on a live session in California. We do those sorts of options. You can go either way. So you can sign up for those. Keep your eyes coming for what's going to be coming up. The advantage of those sessions when they're true live is they're up to date. And you can talk about what happened immediately, and that can make it very, very helpful. So you want to start looking for those. The state societies will start issuing those catalogs here shortly. You can start signing up for the courses, find the things you're going to want to know for the coming years, and look there. So keep your eye on that. This has been Current Federal Tax Developments for the week of March the 9th, 2020. Current Federal Tax Developments are, you know, going to be brought to you, as always, by Kaplan and your state society. If you have any questions or comments, you can send it to me, edzollers@currentfederaltaxdevelopments.com. You can follow me on Twitter. There I go, @edzollers is what you'll find me there as we post updates to go on. I discuss on Reddit at the /r/taxpose subreddit, and I'm involved in discussions on state societies. I'm involved in the Tax Talk group from CalCPA that's open to CPAs from across the country. I'm also involved in the groups for members only in Arizona, Minnesota, and New Jersey. So if you're there and you're on the Connect sites for those societies, you can check in. And otherwise, well, we plan to be back here a week from now on actual first extension day for our pass-through. So we'll see what comes up this week. I'm pretty certain we're going to talk a letter the AICPA sent out at the end of last week. We'll look at more detail regarding IRS's unofficial guidance on 199 Cap A. If you've not looked at that letter, I suggest you take a look at it. It's an interesting letter. We'll see if the IRS does anything about that. We'll talk about other things. We do know that OIRA this week finished their review of the, we talk about the carried interest rules that are going to come into play for those gains. That's there. We may see those regs out this week. We'll see what other stuff happens. And anything happens, we'll hopefully give you some discussion next week about what's happening and what's going on here in the area of federal taxes. And until then, as I said, have a good week. Finish up those extensions, and we'll see you here next.